the little chant Stephen just did is a tradition we have in Theravada Buddhism of which comes from the texts. When the Buddha realized enlightenment, then he was apparently reluctant to teach because he thought it was so subtle and difficult. And then the god Brahma Sahampati, which in Indian mythology is the god of verse, the god of poetry and the god of speech, I suppose, came to him and said, "Please teach for those who have only a little dust in their eyes." So that's us. And it's true, because we, how many people want to do this? And people really would put so much effort forth in their worldly life, first of all, to get free time, the finances involved, setting everything up just to come here, and then endure. It's quite difficult to just be with yourself, be with your mind, be with your body, day in and day out. It's a huge challenge. So keep reflecting on that, no matter what the particular experience of the retreat is, that the fact that you're willing to give it a go, to try to understand yourself, to endure discomfort and all the rest of it. These are very noble things to be doing. Sometimes the manifestation of the mind doesn't seem so terribly noble, but that's just a habit, just the echoes of the mind. But if you keep remembering what's the underlying aspiration and energy you're putting into that, remember that, then you tend to have a more an inner voice which is more encouraging, rather than just critical and judgmental. Because that's very easy, just to be very judgmental. So try to keep that in focus, the nobility of just sitting through for an hour. No matter what the quality is, even if the mind's all over the planet, just the fact that you're willing to be here with that is very skillful, because there are qualities of mind which are being cultivated that are not perhaps apparent right now, but then over the life of the retreat and then later on, the ability to be patient, the ability to reflect, the ability to observe the way things are, these become powerful aspects of consciousness. And it pays off, it pays dividends. Buddhism's really good that way. I rang my mom, she's in good form. So that's a relief. I was really looking forward to coming to this retreat. I haven't been away for 6 months now, I think. So I think I needed a bit of break. Caregiving can get pretty intense. My mother's a great woman to be with, so there's no problem. But just getting some perspective on what one's doing, getting away from the situation, so we're all in a similar boat, that we can step back from our families, our responsibilities, our work situations, and get some distance from that, and get some understanding that way. That's very helpful, very important. Personally, I was really exhausted this afternoon. I had a kip at the last walking. Felt great. So that's quite common too, that you bring into the retreat certain levels of tension, exhaustion, tiredness, or emotional, if there's been some loss, or so there might be grief coming up, or all kinds of things begin to manifest in consciousness, because now there's a lot of space. We're not having to keep our schedules going and keep doing this and that, but we have a chance now to just let go. So this would be quite natural. If you feel exhausted or you feel grief or sadness, this is a kind of purification of the heart and body and mind and energy and all of that. So do allow for that, allow for this kind of whatever comes up to come up. And as I was saying earlier, if you feel really exhausted, don't worry about getting a good kid. That's what the bed's for. Even though it's high and luxurious. So trying to find a balance between just some kind of fierce asceticism, let's say, that would be one extreme, and then an indolent attitude and a wise attitude. Being diligent is important, obviously, and I've never found on the retreats I do that people are very diligent. So have a sense for what your energies are and be kind to that, try to be diligent. So the first few days of retreat often have those kinds of aspects to them. Exhaustion, tiredness. You have to be very, very patient, very compassionate, and just trust in awareness. Just keep trusting in the kind of process of the retreat to let it do its work. On a retreat, we, and generally in Buddhist practice, we adopt a reflective attitude to the way things are. And this ability to reflect on our conscious experience is much, much different than just having a lot of beliefs about Buddhism. That's the wonderful thing about a retreat, is that whatever beliefs you have, it's what you actually, your wisdom is which pays off. I might have all kinds of textual knowledge about Buddhism, but if it hasn't become transmuted into insight, then I'll still suffer. Right? So the reflective attitude that we adopt is one of witnessing to the movement of consciousness, and especially witnessing to suffering, to the any forms of discontent, boredom, stress, whatever it might be, any sense of lack, and we try to go right towards those very, very important feelings, because the teaching is quite simply, it's pitched to suffering and the end of suffering. Very simple, that one. When one sees the elaborations of Buddhism in Tibet, in China, in Thailand, in Sri Lanka, much of those elaborations are cultural, obviously. The art, the ritual, the superstition that exists, the layers and layers of iconography upon iconography. So it seems terribly complex. You can see terribly, terribly complex. If you look at the texts, some of the things we're going through are in the Living Dhamma group, they're pretty complex. But if one remembers that the real thing the Buddha was talking about was suffering and the end of suffering, just that, then the approach is fairly straightforward. And a reflective attitude on suffering, and the word in Pali is dukkha, of course, but suffering maybe sounds too huge. It can be subtle things like boredom or minor forms of not being sure, to the kind of the major things of grief and sorrow and pain or pains of various sorts. So any form of discontent that we experience needs to be understood, and the reflective attitude then tries to see suffering or discontent as something in consciousness rather than something that I have a problem, say. So if I'm concerned about my mother, on a worldly basis I need to make sure I've got the cell phone and my brother's covering things and so on. So that's done. Right? That's the personal aspect. And then as Dhamma, this is worry. This is suffering. This is not being sure. This is a reflective mind. Right? So we try to disengage from the sense of my problem, just to the very nature of consciousness when it's not at ease. Consciousness when it is in some mode of discontent. So in the Four Noble Truths teaching, we say there is suffering, That's the basic teaching that Theravada Buddhism is, and I think all of Buddhism, is really based upon. And the Four Noble Truths are something that need to be, I think, continually reminded and deepened. They are sometimes sort of dismissed as the beginning teaching. Oh, that's beginner stuff. Let's get on to whatever. So there's a tendency to not go deeply into the Four Noble Truths. And I think to understand a tradition, be it this tradition or another tradition, one needs a certain amount of teaching, but one needs to really go very deeply into it with the reflective mind, rather than accumulate a lot of information which can keep us rather shallow. So the ability to reflect on suffering, there is suffering. The way that's stated, there is suffering, it's not I am suffering, there is suffering. And the ability to do that in consciousness, the ability to say, well, I'm really worried. Oh no, there is worry. Worry feels this way. Is that step to objectivity? And that's what we mean by the reflective mind. And that some people are not very reflective. They like, say, people who tend to sort of kind of fundamental positions around religion. They like belief. They like to take positions. It's like this, it's like this, it's like this. So a kind of fundamentalist Buddhist would be one who would believe in Buddhism but might not really reflect on it. He might kind of have a academic understanding of Four Noble Truths, but they might still suffer. And I've met academics who use Buddhism very, very well, but I've met some who know the information, but still get caught in surprising mind states. So it's how do you take a teaching and make it alive in your own mind. So during this retreat, any form of discontent you have, be it restlessness, wanting the bell to stop, wanting your mind to be quiet, keep reflecting. Now this is discontent. This is having something that I don't want. This is not getting what I wanted to get. See that? You have to really approach that. And be willing for that to become manifest. Not just try to get rid of it or figure it all out. Just really wait. This is what discontent feels like. So there is suffering. And suffering has to be understood. This is related teaching as is stated in the Four Noble Truths. Suffering has to be understood. You have to stand under it. You have to be willing to be with it. So, like in the sitting, around, what is it, 3:30, 4 o'clock, that sitting, this leg started to die on me. You know the dead leg? You ever had that one? And you know, it started to kind of hip and all of that. And then, okay, this is pain. And where's the suffering in that? Just kind of watching. Now, an unreflective mind, not reflecting on that, would maybe just say, oh no, what am I going to do? And I'm not going to move. I'm just going to sit through this. That's not a reflective mind. That's a dictatorial mind. Right? That's a tyrannical mind. Another type of mind is, it hurts, I'm moving. That's not a reflective mind, it's a restless mind. A reflective mind awakens to the fact of pain and doesn't take a position that I should or shouldn't move, but says, well, where's the suffering? There's something wrong here. What's the suffering? And takes that as the object of contemplation, takes the very pain, the very much discomfort, and observes, well, what is suffering here? What does it feel like? Where is the suffering? What is it? And that, of course, leads to the second noble truth, that the cause of suffering is craving, wanting. So wanting to move and not wanting pain is pretty natural. There's nothing wrong with that. Right? But pain and physical discomfort are something that if we don't understand them, and we always need to get away from them, then we, when we have pain which we can't get away from, what do? We're stuck. So to actually take the time before one moves, without, not saying you can't move, but just to take the time for the 5 or 10 minutes where it's, you know, it's not going to cripple you, and to actually use that as a way of understanding the second, the Four Noble Truths. So there's suffering. What's the cause now? And then you say, well, there's the physical sensation. It's unpleasant, and there's the desire not to have that. There's the wanting. And what's the difference between wanting and just the sensation? And that's what you can observe. You can see that the physical sensation is as it is. It's burning, it's tight, and then there's a restlessness around it. A kind of wanting to get out of that, not wanting to be with it, wanting to get away from, wanting to lift off it, aversion. And that's the language I use, but in the meditation around that, it's not intellectual, say. It's like just applying attention to that. Where's peace in this? Or what was suffering? And just popping a little question or two, and just waiting and watching and learning. And that sense of openness to discontent allows insight to arise. You begin to see the difference between pain or just physical sensation and the desire to get rid of physical sensation. You begin to notice where the mind is on that, notice the resistance to it. And that is how insight grows. You just intuitively understand how that works. So the cause of suffering is craving or wanting. And wanting has to be abandoned. So it has to be let go of. And so we have the famous line, letting go. And you think that if you, I'll just let go and it'll be pleasant. Well, it's not, is it? Pain is pain. And it's there for a reason. So it's okay to move. But to take that exercise of, so what would be the letting go of wanting? What would that mean? And you can't just force yourself as an intellectual, okay, let go, right? That won't work, right? You can't just, it's not a matter of willpower, it's a matter of understanding what letting go is. What is the abandonment of craving? So then you think, well, abandonment of craving, I don't want this, well, what if I just spread metta to it? You can stay here for 2 hours. No way. Or... But contrast that to just this attitude, I have to sit. This kind of rigid, I have to sit, I can't move. Or just moving all the time. And that's the reflective mind that we can use. That leads to the third noble truth, is that there is a cessation of suffering. There isn't a cessation of unpleasantness. So if you think a cessation of suffering is going to, that life will always be pleasant, you'd be disappointed. So pleasant and unpleasant are just part of the movement of consciousness. It's just the way it is. And if I take a position with pleasantness, then unpleasantness is a challenge. So to see that the letting go of wanting, it's just this way now. And begin to find some sense of peace around something that you don't want. You don't want the pain, but you find, well, it's all right, it's just pain. And then you can move. It's all right to move. But that whole kind of reflective attitude, there is discontent, there's a cause. The cause is the attachment to wanting. So it's the wanting that's important, not the pain. Take that with an emotion, say like you feel grief or sadness or like I feel anxious about my mother, right? Now that arises in consciousness because of causes and conditions. Right? So it's quite natural for me to feel anxious about my mother's care right now because I've been taking care of her, I just got this report from the doctor, etc. So that's natural. What else? And I feel, oh great, I'm out of here. Too bad, Mom. that would be unnatural. So anxiety arises. And then, so what's the problem there? What is the real problem? Well, the anxiety is conditioned into the mind, and where's the craving? I want security. I want my mom to not have pain. I want to know, make sure she doesn't have pain. But I can't do that. I have no choice around that. So this is anxiety. And I'm not sure, not being sure. It feels this way. And it's okay. So the problem is not the anxiety. That's already conditioned into the mind because of all I've done. So the problem in the moment, is the not wanting of the anxiety, wanting to get rid of the anxiety, wanting to be sure. So, or maybe it's grief, or sorrow, or sadness, or fear, or anger, all those kinds of things will come up because it causes a condition. There's nothing wrong with that. If you feel annoyed at someone on the retreat, that's all right. It's just annoyance. And then that comes up in the mind. What's the problem? Is it the annoyance? Well, yeah, kind of, but right now the annoyance is there. And so what is it? Where's the cause of suffering? I don't want the annoyance. I don't want this to be that way. Fear. I had it took me a long time to figure out the problem. My problem with fear was not wanting the fear. It took a lot of heavy duty ignorance to get through. So I'd meditate and I'd concentrate and I'd do all kinds of practices to be brave. But I didn't see, well, this is fear has arisen. That's suffering. It goes this way. And what is the wanting? There's the fear, there's the emotion. What's the wanting? And what's the letting go of the wanting? And once I figured that out, that the fear wasn't the problem, it was the not wanting of the fear. Then fear began to really come up. It got worse, I think. But it was okay, because now it had a chance to sort of come through consciousness. Well, that's just fear. There it is again. Oh, yeah. And then I get to know it in the body. What is fear like as a physical experience? Where is it like in the guts? How does the breath affect it? So then fear, that thing which I thought I didn't want, and I didn't want, I began to use that as a sort of exercise in first presence. Understanding the body, understanding the wanting, letting go of the wanting. Huge exercise, big exercise. And that's the reflective mind, isn't it? The reflective mind. So whatever I'm afraid of, or what I'm angry about, or I'm anxious, doesn't really matter. The object doesn't really matter so much anymore. Especially in this kind of a retreat situation. So there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. There is the cause of the attachment to wanting, and that has to be abandoned. And there's the cessation, and that cessation has to be realized. So there are moments in consciousness, quite a lot of moments actually, where the mind is actually not wanting. It's just, it's okay. Usually when the bell rings, say. That's the minimalist approach. Bell rings, relief. No more trying, no more, maybe you get critical, but the moments like after, when you know the space between a thought, is quite often a moment of not wanting, not craving. So noticing that the times in the mind when you're just open, nothing to do, nowhere to go, you're ordinary. Maybe just having a cup of tea, looking out to the river. Quite often that's the best time. You know, you try so fiercely on a cushion, right? It doesn't work, and you go have a cup of tea. Oh, well, I just have a cup of tea all day. But that won't work either, will it? Huh? So you have contrast. You have contrast of like a formal sitting, and then you have walking outside. But you try to come to realize the end of suffering. Now, the realizing the end of suffering can sound very grand, so that you become some enlightened person, and that has validity in the text. But then that becomes unapproachable. There's some far distant experience that you and I may or may not experience in 2,000 lifetimes from now, something like that. But actually just the little moments of cessation, you know, where just let go of worrying. That's why I like this language. Just be open and receptive. Let's say, like, waiting for a talk. Like, so the sitting ends, and you're sitting there, waiting for something to happen. And it's just let your mind, just nothing happening. It's all right. Because the mind can be so much always looking and trying to find something, trying to become something. And we miss this very, very simple fact that when we just allow things to be, there's a cessation of suffering, cessation of craving, cessation of wanting. So desirelessness, the end of desire, is synonymous with nirvana. Right? So any time where you just listen and you come to that sense of not craving. That's why I've been starting these meditations with just listen and try to just get a sense of just receptive, aware, nowhere to go, non-becoming. That's the cessation of wanting, right there. Now if you take that as a position, right, next thing, okay, cessation of wanting. Just listen, where is it? You're stuck again because you want to experience the cessation of wanting. So, how do you talk about it? But that has to be realized. Okay, that has to be realized. Non-becoming. Now, if you can realize that with something like something negative, like fear or loneliness, let's say you're on this retreat and you really miss someone you love. Your children or your partner or whatever, and that comes up into consciousness. Well, that would be natural, wouldn't it? You know, someone that you live with and you love and you care for, and it gives you a certain amount of open-heartedness, and then that's not there. Separation from the loved ones is suffering. That comes into consciousness. Well, how else should it be? That's natural. But then that can be known. You should know, this is the feeling. This is the feeling of not being with someone I love, feeling of being lonely, whatever. And just bear witness to that. And let it cease. Let it cease into the peace of the mind. Let it end into the peace of the mind. And that's the reflective mind. The unreflective mind keeps having to do something about it. You have to meditate so I don't feel this. But we're human. We have hearts. We feel things. Now, if our life is lived purely at an intellectual level, then I think we're very limited. So, what I suggest is when you feel any kind of discontent, ask your body, how does this feel, body? So, if you feel lonely or you feel just grumpy or confused or whatever, don't just take it to thought all the time. But just kind of expand your awareness to the body. Say, okay, body, this anxiety I'm feeling about my mother, what does the body say about that? And you begin to be like what we call body witness to suffering. And you say, oh, wow, the out-breath is really shallow, or the chest feels really contracted, or the head feels tight, or whatever. And you begin to witness to suffering and discontent in a much more profound way. Because thought, when I'm thinking, say if I speak about anxiety, when I'm thinking anxious thoughts, I'm very far from the energy of anxiety. I've already taken myself away from it. So I need to come closer to it. I need to be more in contact with it. And thinking takes you away from it. So right thought is like taking you back to, oh, this is the way it is now. And going towards something like anxiety or any kind of discontent I have. And they're not trying to fix it. They're just bearing witness to it. This is where the deep peace of the mind comes. The deep peace of the mind. So like the experiencing the pain in my leg, if I just forcefully, so I'm not going to move for half an hour, I might do it, limp out, right? But I won't be peaceful. It might be egotistical. And you might think, oh, he can sit there, he's great. But big deal. I used to do that. I used to kind of just sit, and then as a young monk, I just kind of sit. Feel very proud that I could sit. And then I know some of the other monks didn't give a damn. I'm very disappointed. Then I started to fall asleep. Because I couldn't use, you know, I realized, well, what's the point of it? So you can be very willful, and then you can kind of just be very, very lax. But to actually take something like the pain in the leg, just be with that, be with the craving, that actually leads to peace, if it's done well. So pain, discomfort, discontent can lead to deep peace if it's done well, if it's done with right understanding, right attitude. And that takes a while to learn, doesn't it? You don't just kind of do it. You struggle with it. You fight with it. Figure out how you can do that in different ways. So there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. Suffering has been understood. This was the formulation of the Buddha's enlightenment. Suffering has a cause, and that cause is attachment to craving. That has to be abandoned. It has been abandoned. There is the cessation of suffering, the cessation of discontent. That has to be realized. You have to notice that. It has been realized. And in the Four Noble Truths, there is the path. This path has to be developed. It has been developed. And to kind of take your conscious experience and keep using those four, keep deepening your understanding of your own mind. Because as long as you're suffering, as long as there's discontent, we're going to be motivated to do something about it. Because we're meant for happiness. You know, I think we are designed for happiness, honest. Suffering isn't a design fault, it's a teaching. So, dukkha, or discontent, is actually an ennobling truth. We say it's a noble truth. It ennobles the mind if we are reflective. If we're not reflective, then it's just a hassle. It's just a burden. Right? It's just a bad joke. But if we're reflective, then there's something, it's calling us, isn't it? Like any kind of discontent, it's calling us and saying, you have to understand me if you're going to be happy, if you're going to be free, if you're going to be peaceful. And as long as we don't understand it, it'll keep calling us. It'll keep, you know, we'll keep having to come back to it because our desire heart wants to be free from suffering, wants to be free from suffering. So any avenues we take which are inadequate or we don't work, it might work for a while. Right? It might work for a while, but then eventually, no, that's not it. That's not it. The usual way that beings who are unreflective deal with discontent is to run away from it. We all do that. We distract. So if you're bored or do something interesting, eat something, listen to some music or whatever, so we usually move away from discontent. We distract from it. Now on a retreat, we've trapped ourselves voluntarily. I mean, you can leave any time, obviously, but we've actually put ourselves in a situation where we're enhancing suffering. We're actually putting ourselves in a situation where we don't have sense distractions, right? Where we're kind of trapped into the sitting here like that, and so suffering arises, and rather than have a way out through a sense distraction, we have to find a way out through our hearts and minds. That's the challenge. Yeah? So if I feel worried or anxious, I have to find a way to be peaceful here now with that. Can't distract it, can't get away from it. I have to figure it out. So being trapped with discontent is very, very valuable. As long as it's not harmful, right? If it's harmful, you get out of there. So we set up a situation which is very harmless, which is wholesome. We're supporting each other in this work. We trust each other. So we can feel fear, say. We can feel those things. It's okay. It's a trustworthy place. And then within that, the challenge is, what does letting go mean? A very difficult word, letting go. Because the letting go of suffering kind of sounds like you just kind of get rid of it. But my take on it is actually letting go is deep connection. It's a kind of paradox. If I feel, let's say, like with the pain in my leg, letting go is letting go of the wanting. And to let go of the wanting, I have to just be with that moment by moment. To really be with the physical sensation of that. Not in a forceful way, just in a very allowing way. So letting go is connection. Or if I feel some anxiety about my mother, what's attachment there? Attachment is the anxiety comes up because the causal conditions, and whoop, it goes up to my head. And I start to proliferate. Oh, what am I going to do? No, 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 no. And then that's attachment. Because I've grasped the energy of anxiety, and I've gotten caught up in thoughts about it. And so thought is driven by not wanting, or wanting of some sort. So non-attachment doesn't mean there is no anxiety. No, non-attachment, really connect now. What is anxiety? What is the suffering? What does it feel like? So it's connection. And you notice how attachment to wanting and thought is a disconnect. Well, now I know I'm feeling anxiety, sure. But I haven't really connected with that feeling. Now imagine if I, for the last, like when I started to kind of work with fear, I had avoided fear for 25 years. Created a persona to avoid the fear. So for 25 years, and how much time before that, who knows, I had developed strategies of being a person. It's called personality, ego. And so having done that for so many years, actually to get in contact with this fear was very difficult, because I had done everything to not recognize it, not know it, not be with it. So that's a problem, isn't it? If I have spent a lot of time avoiding something, and now I'm saying, well, what does this really feel like? The habit will be to get away from it, to analyze it, to think about it. So any kind of discontent you might experience, see how when it goes up into thought, you're no longer aware of it. You know it's there, but you're not really aware of it as an energy. So can I look at these things as like an energy form in the body and explore it and get to know it till it can't fool me anymore? Not get rid of it. It'll take care of itself. Now once I can be with the energy of discontent, with the physical manifestations of it, with the bodily manifestations of it, then what happens is that whole energy system doesn't get kind of coagulated with that. You know, when I feel when anxiety comes up in consciousness and I start thinking anxious thoughts, my mind gets it's like concrete, it's really tight. Right? My breath gets shallow. And so that whole energy becomes sort of like a blood clot, a brain clot. It kind of gets tight. So to actually bring you know, to not dismiss the mood of the mind, to bring it down into the body, to come down from the thinking mind, not with a desire to get rid of it, but to feel it in the heart, to feel it in the breath, to become conscious of all that, and then just to let it be, let it manifest, let it make its own statement. And that's non-desire. I'm not desiring to do anything about it. Then what happens to that energy? It runs its course, and the whole energy system of the mind body has a lovely flow to it, and that's peaceful. It's a peaceful flow. One has to be patient. One has to sometimes explore, because even though one knows the language of allowing things to be and letting go, the habit can be so strong. Even though I understood, my teachers would say, "Well, just Let it be there, Dhamma. You just welcome it. You know, just have compassion for your fears. Yeah, I'll have compassion for my fear. But the subtext of my mind was, get out of here, I don't want you, because I've not wanted you for so many years. So sometimes there's a struggle in trying to just understand, what is it that I want here? What is it I'm trying to get rid of? And then you have to wait. You have to allow suffering to be understood. You have to allow it to manifest, not try to fix it. It takes a lot of patience and trust and awareness. So what I've been recommending is this underlying attitude. This is where it is now. Receptive, open, attentive, trusting in that. And then when the discontent comes up, be willing to explore it. Not in a forceful way, but just in a curious way. The patterns of suffering that we experience, I don't think are that varied, actually. If I understand one mode of fear, I've understood all fear. If I've understood one aspect of one, like if in this retreat I feel really ticked off at someone, yeah, and I disengage from that, you know, I don't believe in the object of my anger. And I say, this is anger. If I can just understand it, I'll understand all anger, won't I? There aren't that many patterns that we have. So the deluded mind, of course, believes in the projections, the fear and all of that. But we're just trying to see this as consciousness. Consciousness and suffering. What's the letting go of suffering? The path has to be developed. And the path begins with, the path really is one of awakening. To awaken to that. So that's why we stress mindfulness so much. To awaken to that. So there is suffering. Suffering has to be understood. Suffering has been understood. Have you understood your suffering? Have I understood my fear? I think I do now. It's taken a long time. So now, let's say when fear comes up, I say, oh, here you go. There you go. It's in the belly, you know. Oh, yeah, I know you. So there's a kind of sense of, oh, here's this old friend again. Come up again. Then there is a cause. The cause is attachment to craving. And that has to be let go. So what is the letting go? And then there's there's an end. There's an end to suffering. It's an optimistic teaching. And that end has to be realized. You have to realize that sense of peace. This ceasing of a thought, whatever it is, has been realized. And the path, you have to develop. And that has been developed. I'll talk about the fourth noble truth more in the future. So take that, and I know most of you have heard that a million and one times, but I don't think you can repeat it too much, because really, if you keep deepening this, it will answer your question, because the question is we want to be free from suffering. That's why we're here. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.